And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Josh S. from San Diego.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. My name is Joshua Sally. I'm an alcoholic. Just to let you guys know, I'm not here to teach anybody anything. I'm not going to try to transmit any kind of information. I'm not going to try to represent Alcoholics Anonymous in any other way than I'm going to share my story as it relates to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and what I did prior to getting sober and what I've done after I got sober and what I continue to do today. So that's kind of the connection that I want to make with you guys tonight is something that somebody shared with me like a year ago. It meant a lot to me when I really sat down and I did it. And what he said was, sit back and think about why God has kept you alive. And I told him my story. This is how it came out. I told him my story, and a lot of my friends are dead. Some people I know are going to do a long time in prison because of drugs and alcohol. And the majority of people that I used with and drank with are now dead because of disease. And what he asked me to do was take it into my meditation and to really sit back and think about why God has kept me alive. And for somebody like me to really be alive today and to be able to carry this message and the message of what God's done in my life is it's an absolute miracle. And when I'm asked to do it, I do it with pleasure. Like our 10-minute speaker said, and the lady that took a cake, Kelly, was saying that it is kind of scary up here. And I do feel comfortable sharing my story with other alcoholics. And it's an amazing thing to be somebody that God has called out and called out from my past life to be here tonight to share my story with you. And I would like to thank John for asking me or giving me this opportunity to come and speak to you guys tonight. And for Randy to okay that. And I do know that usually 45-minute speakers here at this meeting are over 10 years sober, and I have a little over 3 years. And I know that that's not a normal thing in Alcoholics Anonymous for people with 3 years to come and speak for 45 minutes. But I've done several speaking engagements, and I really enjoy doing it. And I do know that if that's not a normal thing, I know that God had his hand in this. And I know that the reason why I'm up here tonight is for one reason and one reason only, and that's to tell my story and what God did in my life. And so I'm going to start off with that. My story contains a lot of drinking, always drinking, and a lot of drug use. And I'm just going to kind of touch on those two things. I'm not really here to qualify to you guys and to let you accept me here. That's not why I'm here tonight. I started drinking and using at a young age. I started drinking around 15 and a half, and that's a pivotal time in a man's age coming, you know, from where I come from. And my dad and my mom split up, and my dad moved to Tijuana, Mexico when I was 15 and a half, and that pretty much meant that there was no more rules in my house. You know, my mom's a little Hispanic lady and my dad's a big white guy, and he left, and I was like, all right, I got no more rules in my life. And that just took me to the streets. And when my dad moved to TJ, I would spend weekends with him, and then I would go to high school, a high school over here. And going back and forth, my mom tried to keep a closer eye on me, and my dad was like, I'm doing my thing. I don't really care what it is that you do. You know, you're 15. And in Mexico, it's different than America. I don't know if anybody's from Mexico, but it's a lot different there. And one of the things that gave me an opportunity to go down the path that I went was when my dad moved there, he would go out and date women and stuff because him and my mom were divorced. And my curfew in a foreign country when I was 15 and a half was, he would tell me, was be home before the sun came up. I was like, that's pretty cool. Cabs were 50 cents from downtown to his house. And we were on the streets after that. I was like, well, you know, you can see the sun coming up about a half an hour. That gives me enough time to get in the cab and be home. I still always listen to what my dad told me to do. And I didn't obey a lot of rules, but when he said something, I knew it was really serious and that I had to obey it. I'm 33 years old right now, and if he tells me to do something today, I still do it. And it's just, it's that respect thing. And it was very... It was very different for me to go from having like a structured family life with my mom, my dad, my brother, we would do all kinds of things, to then having no structure anymore. And I know that drinking and using became part of my life because there was no rules, and it was easier for me to be around people that did those kinds of things. And when I was in high school, man, I wasn't like the coolest kid. I always hung out with the outcasts. I just felt more comfortable with, you know, society's rejects are basically the kind of people that I hung out with. And that led me down a lot of different paths, and with music. And, you know, to me, the people that I chose to be around drank and used. Those are the people that I gravitated towards. I didn't like hanging out with the cheerleaders, but they did buy drugs for me, and I was okay. I was cool with that. So people would always see me hanging out with the cheerleaders. They're like, why is that dude hanging out with the cheerleaders? They're like, oh, well, he, you know, sells drugs to them, whatever. So that's what I did. And they definitely didn't invite me to any of their parties, but they would always talk to me prior to their parties. So that's kind of one thing that that I would do. Yeah. All right. There we go. Thank you. So that was like something that I did in my life. And being an outcast like that, like I like that when people would look at me a certain way and think like, oh, you know, that guy's crazy or whatever. So that definitely played a big part in me getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, I always drank. My friends and I were always drinking. If I made it to high school that day, like there was definitely, you know, alcohol after high school. And I was a big 40-ounce drinker back then. And I just remember going to all these different liquor stores around here and, you know, getting alcohol and where we would go to drink and whose parents weren't going to be home. And then at around, you know, 17, 18, I knew that, like, drinking and driving was a really bad thing to do, so I just didn't get a driver's license, and I didn't drive till I was 22 years old. I never had a driver's license until I was 22 years old. I did drive. My first car was a Cadillac Coupe de Ville, 1962, and we torched the springs and slammed it to the ground, and we would drive that around, and whoever had a license that was in the car at the time was designated driver, and we just had a lot of fun, man. I grew up over here in La Mesa, and then in between Tijuana and La Mesa is where I lived, and then at like 16 or 17 years old, I moved downtown, and I lived downtown and on 10th and Market around that area, and that was like a downhill spiral from, you know, coming from a family life in La Mesa to living on Market Street in downtown, and then going back and forth from TJ to downtown was like, you know, I didn't really have a lot of choices. So I did graduate high school. One of the best things that ever happened to me, man, is I got my diploma on time, and I was like, all right, that's great. Now I can get a job. And so I went to work, and I did odd jobs. I did, like, screen printing and stuff. And when I was about 18 years old, I was hanging out in Mission Beach. Through 17, 18 to about 20, I was hanging out in Mission Beach, and there was a lot of people doing more drugs. I always drank a lot, didn't do a lot of drugs till I was about 18 years old. And it turns out that most people would go to TJ to get drugs. And I was like, well, that's funny because I speak Spanish and my dad lives there, so we can go down there, party all night. I'll show you guys where to get drugs, and then we'll just come back across the border and do our thing. And that worked for a while. You know, it wasn't like it is today. It wasn't as strict crossing the border with, you know, drugs as it was back then. So we would go down there and buy like tons of pharmaceuticals and then come across and sell them on the boardwalk. And that got us into a lot of trouble and a lot of fights and, you know, lots of guns and mace. It's just like a big blur from like 18 to 20. And so I kind of was doing these pharmaceuticals and selling them and drinking the whole time. I've woke up in Mission Bay Park like numerous times, like just looking around going like, what am I doing? You know, like, you know that that's not the proper way to live your life is when you wake up in a park, you know, you're like, it's like 12 o'clock in the afternoon and there's people like playing with their kids and you're like, what am I doing here? I can't believe I got, you know, how did I get here? And So then, you know, doing those pharmaceuticals, and I was really, really stoked on the downer thing, and I wasn't a real big, you know, upper kind of guy, but drinking was always a big part of, you know, my drug use. And I remember when I was 20 years old, I was with a friend of mine, and we didn't really have any more drugs, and we were drinking, and somebody turned us on to heroin, and I don't want to get too much into that story, but it was a big part of my life, man. It was a big part of my story, and I was on the intravenous drug use for, like, over 10 years daily, and it was a thing that I did in my life that was, I just couldn't stop, and I understood exactly what it meant to be powerless over alcohol and drugs, and I would try, man, with every single effort that I had in my body, I would try, and I would wake up and I would say, today I'm not going to get loaded anymore, today will be the day. And like 6 hours later, I'd get sick and my nose would start running, and I would go to the Connect and I would just get loaded again. And I, you know, there's a thing in the book on page 22. And it says, if hundreds of experiences have showed him that one drink means another debacle with all its intended suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that first drink? And that kind of thing never crossed my mind when I was drinking, but it did definitely cross my mind when I started going through this work. So my alcoholism and drug addiction took me till I was, I guess, like 28 years old was the first time I heard about 12-step programs. And the way I got to AA and NA was very weird. I was actually living in Mexico at the time, and I went to one rehab in my entire life. I've only been to one rehab, and it was in Mexico. And I don't know if anybody understands the difference between a free country and a country that's a third world country. Is you're not really free there, even though you think you are. We go to Mexico and we do whatever we want, but they can't do that. They can't leave, so they're not completely free. And I thought rehab in Mexico was like rehab here, and if I didn't like it, I could leave, and that's not the case. And yeah, I checked myself. My little brother drove me to a rehab and then drove back home. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm gonna, you know, this is my first opportunity of being clean. And I was like, oh, gung ho for it. I was very sick, like the second or third day, and I was like, I don't think I could take this. And they're like, well, we'll take you into the office and talk. And so I was in there talking to them, and they go, well, we're gonna call your family. And then I found out that you can sign yourself in, but you can't sign yourself out. And I was like, that doesn't even make any sense. Like, I'm trying to, like, rationalize the thought process with this guy. And he's like, it doesn't matter what you're telling me. You're, like, 3 days kicking heroin, and I'm, you know, I'm running this, like, rehab, and you're not going to be able to talk yourself into leaving this place. So we'll get your parents, you know, your family, your dad will come, and we'll try to figure that out. And that was my first idea of it, and I met some guys in that rehab from over here that were living down there, too, and we got into some pretty pretty stupid things to do in a foreign country. I mean, you know, basically, I don't want to get into criminal activities or anything like that. I'm not going to glorify my disease at all. But basically, I had to leave Tijuana, and I was 28 or 29 years old. And with intravenous drug use and the things that I was doing in a foreign country in Mexico, I knew in my heart that I was not going to see 30. I absolutely knew it. I was like, if I make it to 30 years old, that's going to be a miracle. And my brother called me up, and I told him, like, vaguely my situation. I told him I had some, you know, troubles, and I needed to get out of TJ for a little while. And he asked me, you know, he's like, well, you can come stay at my house, but, you know, I know something's up, and you need to go to this little outpatient program a few times a week. And he opened up his house to me, man, and I'm forever grateful to my brother for doing that. And so I went to this outpatient program, and he told me where meetings were, and I was like, okay, these people go, and they have it. There was actually the first meeting I ever went to was an AA meeting. It was a bonfire meeting behind a fire station in Yuma, Arizona, which was like in the middle of the desert. It was in nowhere. And I had lived in D.C. for 5 years, and then I moved to TJ, so I was living there, and I was like, you want me to go to a bonfire meeting? And what do they do there? And he's like, I don't know anything about it. I just know you need help, and they, you know, these people will help you. I was like, all right, I'll go, man. I'll do anything. So I went and I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, and I started going to these meetings. But the thing that I did at that time was I understood that hanging out with sober people was a way that a lot of people stayed sober. And I thought that would work for me. It didn't seem out to be the case. So 2 years later, after several relapses and certain things happened in my life, I got sober again. And And I met some people in AA and NA, and as I came across the border, I made a call to a friend of mine, and I said, you know what, dude, I can't do this anymore, man. I was sitting on the guardrail in Tijuana, and I had a handful of dope, and I was getting ready to get loaded, and I was an atheist up until like my ninth day sober, and I didn't believe in God. I never did foxhole prayers ever, not one time. If I would get in trouble and I would be handcuffed in the back of a cop car in Mexico, I would just, you know, kind of talk them into I've been driven to the ATM to get out of going to jail in Mexico. So that's what I would do. I would just like, here's my last shot. Like, I got some money somewhere, you know, if you can let me go. And there was no foxhole prayers of any kind. And I was sitting on the guardrail in the river, and I just opened up my hand, and I was looking at that, and I was looking at the people that were there also, and I was like, man, this is no way to live. This is absolutely no way to live. Just, you know, all I did was I would go throughout the day trying and doing things that would try to, you know, get me to get loaded again. And I just prayed right then and there. I said, God, you know, whatever it is you want me to do, I'll do it. All I know is that I can't do this on my own, and I need help. And I actually got in my truck, and I was driving on the freeway to in Mexico to cross the border to come back over here, and I threw good drugs away out the window. Like, I couldn't believe I did that, and I was like, well, I guess God does things for us that we can't do on our own. And you know, as I was crossing the border, I wasn't feeling great, and I was thinking that that might not have been the best idea. And I remember it specifically. I totally remember that day specifically. As I was driving across the border, my phone didn't have service until I crossed the border. So there was pretty much, once I was in the line, there was no turning back and going back to where I was, you know, just coming from. So as I crossed the border, I called out to my friend, and you know, he said, well, why don't you come to a meeting with me tonight? I'm going to like a young people's meeting in PB. So I went and met him at his sober living. He was living in a sober living in PB, and I met him when he had 30 days and I had like 9 months, and then when I relapsed, he stayed sober. And he had made the transition from NA to AA, and I thought that was like, I didn't really understand the reasons why at the time. And when I came back, he's like, well, why don't you try going to Alcoholics Anonymous with me? And I was like, you know what, man, I just made that decision. I'm down to do anything. I don't care where it is. You know, I'll go anywhere. So we walked a few blocks down to this AA meeting at the Cash Street Alano Club, and I remember I had like a Padre hat on really low, and I had a hooded sweatshirt over my head because I was starting to get sick, and I was really mad that at everything. And I remember just sitting over there. I was just sitting over there, and I just remember sweating, and like I was just pissed. You know what I mean? I was so mad that I failed again. You know, I was just a complete failure at everything. I couldn't even stay clean, and I kept relapsing. And We talked for a while, and I went down to that Alano Club, and then we had talked, and he said something to the extent of, you know, why don't you try doing the things that they actually suggest that you do in AA and NA? And I go, but I like just going to meetings and the fellowship and staying sober one day at a time. And basically the conversation was that doesn't seem to work for you. And that proved true, because here I am kicking dope again and like sick and just a complete mess. And I said, you know what, man, maybe you're right. You know, maybe you're right. Maybe this time I'll do, you know, the other stuff, like, you know, read the book and get a sponsor and work the steps. I go, you know what, I'll try that out this time. So we walked down to the Alano Club, and I just remember, I don't remember anything anybody said, to be honest with you. I just remember feeling like, you know what, I felt okay. It was okay. I was okay being back in a meeting. And I knew that there was that 1 hour out of my day that I wasn't going to get loaded, and I didn't feel like drinking or using. And I knew that. So when I was in that meeting, I felt okay. And I went to meetings all that week. That night, a friend of mine showed up in my life, a girl that I had dated in the program, and she offered me a place to stay and that I could kick at her house so I wouldn't be alone. And, you know, I'm forever grateful to her, too. And I don't know if she's sober right now, but you know what? God uses other people to get us to where we need to be, and I really believe that she was a vehicle that God used in my life. And so on my seventh day sober, it was a Friday, And I'm still sick. I'm not doing great. And I went to this meeting, and it was it's still out of control. I go to this meeting all the time. It's really crosstalk and loud and disruptive, and I have fun there. It's really, you know, you've been there before, right? So it's really fun. I enjoy going, man. I go there to see my friends and carry the message of AA, you know. So I'm sitting at that meeting, and they give out tokens for 90 days in a year, whatever. And this guy goes up to take a token, and they say, you know, his sponsor goes up with him to hand him his token, say his little thing about him. And so he's standing there, and he goes, yeah, this is, and he says the guy's name, and he goes, he suffers from grave emotional and mental disorders. He lacks the capacity to be honest, and he can't stay sober. And he hands the guy a token, and he goes and sits down. And I was like, yeah. Everybody's laughing. I go, that guy's going to be my sponsor. And I knew. I mean, I'm not saying that that's right or wrong or whatever. But what I will say is that that's the kind of guy that I needed. I needed somebody who was going to look at me and be absolutely honest with me to an extent I've never done that with anybody else. And I've had sponsors before. They don't tell me to do anything, so I don't do anything. I don't ask them what to do. So they wouldn't tell me what to do. I wouldn't call them. So I tried the easier, softer, half measures crap, and it did not work for me. So I asked this guy, and I went downstairs after the meeting, and I asked him, I didn't like the whole sponsorship thing. It was like an authority figure. I don't do good with authority, and neither do you, I guess. So I went downstairs, and I remember asking him, I go, will you take me through the steps? You know, would you take me through the steps? That seemed like an okay thing. It didn't make our relationship very serious. So he goes, he looked at me kind of like up and down, you know, he looked at me and he goes, you know, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? And I was thinking about, I was like, yeah, man, I'm ready to do that. And he goes, are you done drinking and using? And I said, yeah, I'm through. And he goes, good, because if you're not, you're going to waste my time and you're going to waste your time. And I was like, okay, that, you know, I can definitely say that, you know, I'm ready to go on with this journey. And he says, okay. And I said, so what do you want me to do? You know, what, I heard you give people assignments and then I got to do step work or whatever. And he said, well, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm sick. You know, like I don't have any big plans. I got no money and I'm sick. So, you know, I'm putting my schedules open. And and he goes, okay, why don't you come over and help me move? And I was like, I'm like 30 pounds underweight and sweating, and you think I'm going to help you move? Are you kidding me? And I made that decision right there. I was like, that's what I got to do, man. That's what I'm going to do, you know. And I went over to his house the next day, and there was like his situation was a little weird at the time. His wife and him were splitting, and he had guys over there helping pack her stuff because she was moving to Vegas. And there was like 7 guys over there. They were like, you know, they were bikers, you know. I never really hung out with bikers. I hung out with, you know, like little gangsters and stuff. And they were like big gangsters. I hung out with like little small-time criminals, you know. So, but it was cool because they were all covered in tattoos and I'm covered in tattoos. So it was like I could totally, you know, I was like, well, I can hang out with these guys. They don't seem like a bunch of nerds. Like I thought people in AA were all nerds. So, I went over there and I was sitting there and I was talking to these guys and, you know, I'm taping up boxes and sweating, and I was like, this, you know, I don't know if I can do this, dude. I'm like 9, you know, 7 days sober or 8 days sober, like sick, you know. So I started asking him, and I, you know, how much time do you have, man? And he goes, you know, I got 90 days. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. This guy's got 90 days sober. That's, you know, that's a big deal because I only had like 7, and I couldn't stay completely sober for a long period of time. And so I asked a few more guys, and I asked the guy, you know, how much time do you have? And he goes, you know, I got 3 years. And I was like, wow, 3 years, that's 3 years is a long time to stay sober for an alcoholic and a drug addict. That's amazing. And then I asked this guy, he's like 6'4", beard, bald, tattooed, biker, like a real biker. And I was like, how long have you been sober? And he goes, I've been sober for 5 years. And I was like, wow, if that dude can stay sober for 5 years, I can totally stay sober for 5 years. And so I was taping boxes and I was moving, and you know, I asked my sponsor, you know, what is it that there's a thing I wanted to read. As I went through with those guys, And I asked him that question. I was thinking one thing in my mind: if it's possible for them to do it, and if all these people in these meetings were telling the truth, then I believe it's possible for me. And on page 25 it says, "But we saw it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to do, but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet." And that's what I did. I asked my sponsor what he wanted me to do that day, and I went to a meeting that night, and he told me to read from the preface of the big book. He told me to read from the preface to page 63 and highlight in two colors. One thing, everything that I related to, and the other color was everything I didn't understand, and that we would get together when I was done and go over that. And he was kind of checking my willingness to see how willing I was really, you know, how much work I was willing to do. So Tuesday night was the night of our big book study, and I went over to his house and I told him I was done, and he said, "Well, come meet me, you know, an hour early. We'll go over that stuff that you read, and we'll see." You know, he was basically qualifying me to see if I was an alcoholic that he could work with. And so we went over there and we were doing step work and we were reading the book together, and it was an amazing experience for me to sit down with some other guy and just have him teach me about the disease and the nature of alcoholism and drug addiction. And we did our big book study, and after that we continued on with doing the work. And when we got to page 63, he said, "All right, now we get down on our knees and we do the third step prayer." And I was like, "Well, I'm not. I mean, I don't know. I can pray right here sitting on the couch, but if you want to get on your knees, feel free. I don't get on my knees." You know what I mean? I was a knucklehead. I just didn't believe that men begged for anything, and I didn't think that getting on my knees would be that any kind of symbolic in any way. I didn't think I needed to do it, and I wasn't going to do it. And he flipped out on me. He was yelling at me, and I was sitting there. He's like, "You told me you were willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol, and you're wasting my time." And right then, something inside of me clicked. And what I was thinking in my head while this dude was yelling at me was, you know what? He's right. If I'm not willing to do this, then there's probably other stuff that I'm not going to be willing to do. And it crossed my mind for that second to, like, you know, this is my opportunity to actually stay sober for the rest of my life. Because if I can't do this now, I'm probably not going to be able. I wouldn't push all my chips in, and that's the kind of guy that I am. I don't hold any chips back in anything that I do. I just, like, I got a 2 and an 8, and I'm like, they're all in. Let's just go for it, you know? And that's what I did. I pushed all my chips in, and I said, you know what, man, you're right, and I know if I don't do this, it might not work for me. And I got down on my knees with that dude, and he put his arm around me, and we did the third step prayer together right out of the book. And like I said, I was an atheist. I hadn't prayed since I was a little kid. I was torn between Catholic Church and Christian Church, and I never really enjoyed going to church. And I knew that right then that I had to do that, you know. And I prayed with him, and I don't know about your guys' experience, if you've done the third step prayer, if you knew, it's an amazing, for me it was an amazing life-changing experience. And I did that prayer, and I couldn't read it as I was praying it. And we did it 3 times. He said we do it for God, for ourselves, and for another human being. And on the 3rd time, it actually came out, and something inside of me changed that day. Something inside of me, I can honestly say that on my 9th day sober, I have not had the desire to drink or use drugs since that day. And when I got up from that coffee table that we were kneeling down at, I was a changed man. Something inside of me clicked that day, and I knew that if I didn't continue on with doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, because all my friends had done that work, they were telling me that the steps and the solutions in the book, and you're not going to have that permanent sobriety unless you do that. So I knew that day, I made that decision to turn my will and my life over to God, and that meant to continue on with the 12 steps. And he got me outlined on my 4th step, and I knew at that time that I had to continue on with the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had seen so many people go up to the podium and say, you know, I stopped calling my sponsor, I stopped working the steps, I stopped going to meetings, and now I'm new again. And I still see that to this day, and the only thing that crosses my mind is, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm going to learn from your mistakes. And I thank people that come back, and they keep coming back, and they admit what they didn't do, and that's the reason why they're new again. And I listen to that, and I can learn from their mistakes, and I don't have to make that mistake on my own. And it says on page 50, it says, here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. And that's exactly what happened to me. There was a revolutionary change that day. And he got me outlined on my four-step. And I went to work immediately on that four-step. And when I was like 45 days sober, he went to Singapore and Guam 30 days each. And he wasn't going to be back for 60 days. So I'm 40-something days sober. He's going to be gone for a few months. And I have a four-step in my truck, under the seat of my truck, because I didn't want anybody to find it. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do, and I knew he had a sponsee that went to our big book study, and his name is Rich. And I was like, dude, I don't know what to do. I don't trust anybody. You know, I don't want to be sharing this kind of information with anybody, you know, just anybody in AA. And we know that AA is not the hotbed of health. So I was like, I'm very weary on who's going to hear this, you know, stuff. And like, it's any big deal, you know. And so I went, and he said, well, come down to this shop. And I did a fifth step at a tattoo shop in Pacific Beach. And we were sitting down at the counter, and people are coming in and looking at the things, and he's making appointments. And I got my notebook open on the counter, and we're doing a fifth step right there. And it was an awesome, awesome experience for me to do that with that guy. And so I shared my fifth step with him, and he's like, you know, you're an absolute train wreck. You're an absolute train wreck. And, you know, the book says, like, we're tornadoes running through the lives of others. And he's like, you're just a disaster, dude. And he said, you know what, immediately continue on with doing this stuff, which means you go home and you sit quietly for an hour. And I was like, that seems like a weird thing to do. Like, why do you want me to go home? Can't I go? And he goes, that's what the book says, dude. That's what you're going to do. And I was like, all right, if that's what the book says, that's what I'm going to do. It's been working since, you know, for years. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. And I went home and I sat there in my room, and I actually did that. And it says we take this book down and we review the first five proposals. And I went over that stuff, and I heard it explained one time, and it made a lot of sense to me. And when I sat there and I thought about it, and I really reflected on my, you know, allergy to alcohol, and the reason why I'm insane is not because I do crazy things or because I can't pay my bills on time. My sponsor pointed out to me that the reason my life is unmanageable is because the whole time I'm not drinking or using, I'm thinking about drinking or using. Therefore, I can't put any heart or passion into anything else that I do, because alcohol is the first thought in my mind. And when I thought about that right there, the whole time that I'm not drinking or using, that I'm thinking about drinking or using, and I was like, that, you know, that means a lot to me. That made a lot of sense to me. And so I was thinking about those first five proposals, the first three steps, and the fourth step. Was I honest and thorough with everything? You know, I've been to meetings where people say, I didn't have that revolutionary change after the fifth step. And my first thought is what the book says is, if you didn't have that, maybe you withheld something. And I really thought about that. And I was like, I had that drastic change. I was free from anger when I did that fifth step. And on page 66, it says, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, these things are poison. And as I review this book, it says eight times that resentments kill alcoholics. I was like, if they're going to say something eight times, it's probably pretty important. And so I thought about it there. And when I left the shop that day, he asked me, he said, you know, just between me and you, if there's anything that you want to tell me that you didn't write down, like, I would really hope that you would, you know, tell me right now, so you don't take that home and you build your, your foundation on sand instead of rock or whatever. So I said, you know what, dude, I knew from the day I got sober that I had to be brutally honest with, you know, with at least the step work. Maybe not the conversations, but at least the step work. And I thought about it, and I was absolutely as honest as I could be at that time with that guy and with my four step. And I continued on meditating. And when I thought about those five stones and them being properly in place, that's how I laid my foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I heard that be explained in a great way was I got married early in sobriety, and we were doing great, man. I bought a house. We had new cars. We had a picture-perfect life if you were looking at it from the outside in. And my wife, we've been separated for a year, and I know that there's only two things that hurt that bad, and one's divorce, and one is the death of a child. And I don't have any kids, but I can imagine how bad that would be. But divorce for me was very, very, very painful, and going through that process of, you know, moving out of the house and all this stuff and losing the house, and it was just one of those things that I had to go through. But when I heard somebody say this, it made so much sense to me. When I reflected that day on my first five stones being properly in place and my foundation being laid in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sobriety has never been shaken. Not one time have I ever thought, you know what, I'm going to drink over this, or I'm going to get loaded over this because it'll make my situation better. Now, at that time, when that was going on in my life, my serenity was turned upside down. My serenity has been shaken, but my sobriety has never been shaken. And I've stayed sober through that whole experience. And I'm going to touch on a little about that towards the end of the meeting and the situation that I'm in because of that. And when I was going through those steps with Tier and doing that work, I went and we did step 6 and 7 together. And then I asked him, you know, what do I do next? And he told me he hadn't done the rest of the steps. He said that he hadn't gone that far. He was scared to go out and make those amends to some of the people that he hurt really bad. He was in fear of doing that, and I totally understand that. And so I went and I was like, I need somebody to continue on doing this. So I met a guy named Pat that I've been watching in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. And what I heard Pat say was the same thing that Kelly said, and he said, I worked the steps right out of the book. So I'm a hustler, and I'm like a finagler, and I was like, if I have Pat continue me with the steps right out of the book, then when Kelly comes back, I won't have to start over, or I won't do anything wrong. And I was like, that makes sense to me. I won't have to like go back, but I can continue doing the work. So I met Pat, and around 40, 50 days maybe, I saw him at a meeting I'd never been to before. I hadn't seen him. He started working, so I didn't see him at night anymore at the meetings at night. And he was just at the Alano Club the day I just happened to be there for some unknown reason. And I had a really bad resentment when I was, you know, around that time frame. And we sat downstairs in the Alano Club, and he asked me, I asked him if he would continue me, taking me through the steps. And he said, sure, I'd love to. So we didn't even go to the meeting. He told me to go get my four step. And I said, well, yeah, it's in my truck because, you know, I didn't burn it or anything like that. I needed those names for my amends. And I went and got my four step out of the truck. Excuse me. And we sat downstairs in the Alano Club for like, I think it was like 5 or 6 hours. And I told him what I'd done since I did steps 1 through 7, but I hadn't gone, you know, 8, 9, 10. And I was telling him about this resentment. I did another fifth step with him. And like I said, I dealt with really bad trust issues. I didn't trust anybody. And I'm still not feeling great. I took 30 days off of work, and I was just going to meetings. And recovery was my whole life when I was new. That's all I did was I would go to work, you know, and I would go to meetings, and I would do step work, and I would study my book. And when we sat down there and talked, you know, I told him how great I was feeling, but, you know, there was something inside of me that was hurting. You know, I had this resentment that I had to get rid of. I did my four step, and he goes, well, you know what, Josh? You know, you made that decision to continue on, and I would do that with you. But we need to take care of this resentment before we go over all this other stuff that you're going to need to do. And I said, okay. So he handed me a pen. It's not the first time that I've had a resentment, and he hands me a pen and a piece of paper, and he goes, I don't really want to hear all this crap that you're going to tell me. He just hands me a pen, and he hands me a piece of paper, and he says, write about it, then we'll be able to discuss the important facts. But as far as you venting on all that stuff, he's like, we don't have time to do that. We know how to do a four-step. That's what I want you to do. So at that time, I did. I wrote it out just like the book says in the columns, and I wrote it out and showed it to him. And it's like one of those things where just writing it out and sharing it with somebody made me free of that resentment a little bit, because I could see what I did. And I could no longer be mad at the other person, and I could see what I did. So I wrote out that resentment, and we continued on. So we did step 6 and 7 together again. We just did a little review. He wanted to see how I did it, and we did that little review together. And then we took my 4-step, and we added a list, 3 different lists of people that I would go make amends to immediately, that I was not comfortable with doing, and then ones that I was never going to do. And he said, we'll start on this list, and we'll work our way down this list, and then we'll just continue on with the list. And he made it very clear to me that amends were not something that I was going to postpone. Basically, the way he phrased it was different, but he meant as soon as you walk out that door, you're making phone calls and you're going to see people to make amends. And so I did. I made my list right then, and I had my 3 lists. And since he told me I needed to be on my 10th step to be doing a daily inventory, we went over the books. We read a lot of the books and when we sat down there, he was explaining to me how to do amends process, and then going through prayer and meditation. And he's my sponsor is an absolute soldier. He wakes up at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and he leaves for work at like 6:30, and he spends at least an hour and a half in prayer and meditation. He reads his Bible every day. He does AA stuff, and he's one of those guys that's like direct. I call him Nextel. He's got Nextel with Jesus. He's like, he's direct connect, like, you know. And I'm like, he's an awesome guy, so he wanted me to get involved in that, and he told me to read pages 84 through 88. And that's something I did every day for like my first year. And I used to do written 10 steps. I'm not going to lie and say I still do that. I do them regularly. I do write out inventories, and I still do step work regularly. But as far as doing like a written out 10 step of a daily inventory, I know I should do it. I can't stand up here and lie to you guys and say that I do it every day. But one thing that I was reading when I was reading those things right there is on page 84, it says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. And that's exactly what happened to me. I can't sit here and say that it's all the step work and it's all these, you know, guys that I've worked with, and it's every time that I get asked to speak at a meeting and all this stuff. All I know is that I've done the suggested things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and alcohol and drugs have been removed from my life. And I've been, you know, over 3 years sober. Is my time's up? Right? This says 9:30. Okay. All right. So there's a thing I would like to read to the newcomers tonight. It's just something that was pointed out to me. I think it's on this page. It'll just take a second. And when I was new and I was an atheist and I didn't even believe in God, I never had any even reason to think why God could use me. I still don't know why God chose me to speak here tonight. I've driven to Provo, Utah to go and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous out there. I still don't know why God chose to use me to be a light for Him. And when I was reflecting on that, something was brought out to me, and here's a little quick thing. It says, Noah was a drunk, Abraham was too old, Isaac was a daydreamer, Jacob was a liar, Leah was ugly, Joseph was abused, Moses had a stuttering problem, Gideon was afraid, Samson had long hair, Rahab was a prostitute, Jeremiah and Timothy were too young, David had an affair and was a murderer, Elijah was suicidal, Isaiah preached naked, Jonah ran from God. Naomi was a widow. Job was bankrupt. John the Baptist ate bugs. Peter denied Christ. The disciples fell asleep while praying. Martha worried about everything. Zacharias was too small. Paul was too religious. Timothy had an ulcer. I'm a heroin addict. Tommy was a tweaker, and Lazarus was dead. So if you think that God can't use you, it's been a beautiful life, and thank you guys for letting me share.